that reincarnation is a definite fact. In the same way, there are very many students who know certainly that this law of cause and effect is in action. But we must realize that this law is working itself out upon other planes besides the physical, and so it is not to be gauged only from one point of view. Suppose we were looking at the underside of some very beautiful tapestry. You will comprehend that, being only able to see the underside, we should have a very imperfect idea of the pattern. Suppose, further, that the tapestry had not been finished. Then still less should we be able to form a clear conception of the design. That is precisely how we stand with regard to the mighty law of karma. We only see the underside of it from the physical plane, because so much of its action belongs to higher levels. Indeed, we might expect scarcely ever to be able to trace it fully from this side. Once more, as in the case of reincarnation, if you will provisionally accept this idea of divine justice, you will find that it is a more satisfactory theory of life than any other, and you may gradually come to hold it as firmly as we do. You will observe that there are only certain hypotheses. Either everything is only blind chance, and we are ruled by caprice, or we are under a regular divine law, and our surrounding are the result of our actions, good or evil, in previous lives. You will admit that you would like to believe in a law of divine justice. There must be a reason for that feeling that man has of always desiring justice. If God is infinitely greater than we, He must surely have this quality. We believe in theosophy that it is a rational necessity that this law should exist, and we see in every direction instances of its working. I can explain it only to a limited extent, because it needs long and careful study, but the broad outline we ought to be able to give, and then the details can be gathered from the literature. Never think that when you have heard a lecture on a theosophical subject, you know all about it. You have only to take up some of our books to see how very much more there is to be known. For in one lecture, it is not possible to give all available information, even on one point. The first great characteristic that I should like you to grasp about this law is that it is automatic in its action, and that therefore there is no possibility of escape from it. Put aside all theories that man will be judged for his actions and punished or rewarded for them. That inevitably suggests to us the thought of an earthly judge, who may be prejudiced or partially informed, or may be more lenient in one case and more severe in another. We prefer rather to speak of the law of cause and effect, because we hold that this is a law which brings us the results of our actions with an automatic precision. In mechanics, we know that action and reaction are equal, and that no force can ever be lost, and we find that precisely the same rule obtains on these higher levels. If you put so much energy into a machine, you will receive back from it so much work as a result. If you put a certain amount of energy into a word, deed, or thought, you will obtain from that also a certain result. For the law of the conservation of energy holds good upon higher planes, just as it does upon this. If you put a certain amount of force into a steam engine, you expect to get a definite proportion back in the shape of work. Not all of it, naturally, because some goes in friction and some is thrown off in the form of heat, but still a fair proportion. If you do not receive back from your engine what you know you may reasonably expect, you at once look for a defect in your machine. It would never occur to you to say that the law of the conservation of energy is false. But when